Okay, good morning. We'll get started. So, just a note at the start, I'm going to try to keep this slightly shorter than normal. There's a big faculty meeting later in the day that I need to get ready for. So, last Friday, we were talking sort of just about the mechanics of building a simulation model. And so the basic idea of simulation is to somehow mathematically model the behavior of a system and to sort of be able to produce representative behavior for a system. Okay. Now our model was something quite specific. It was a sequence. What we wanted to generate in the end is a sequence of events, possibly time, or in our case, always time-stamped events. These events are what are called discrete events, and what that means is that our assumption is that the system stays in some way stable for a period of time, and then something radical changes about it. Okay, so the state changes. And that change of state is either triggered or denoted, indicated by an event. Okay. And so what we know about the system is encapsulated in that sequence of events, plus knowing something about the underlying model and what sequence of states would have gone along with that event. And so we took a look at sort of the mechanics of building that sort of model last time. And so the big things are sort of deciding what the logic is for the system. So how do events occur? So how do we move from state to state? Being able to, in some way, represent time in a non-deterministic fashion. So we assume that time has some sort of distribution to it, a probabilistic distribution. And so how do we generate times according to those probabilistic distributions? And, again, just a few mechanics of how we sort of track in our model the state of the system and the idea of having a future events list to do that. Okay. So today we're going to assume we have our model. We have some way of recording or observing our events, and we'll see later maybe some other information. And now we want to ask the question, well, what conclusions can we come to about our model? Okay. And sort of the statistical analysis we can perform on the model. So the references are the same ones as for the last lecture. The notes are taken pretty directly from Harry Parros. In some cases, I might have expanded a bit, but yeah, all the sort of critical bits are in there. And again, if you want sort of a more detailed treatment of pretty much the same material, Jerry Banks et al. Is a very good reference, and there's a number of copies of those in the library. There's loads of editions, but they all say pretty much the same thing. The examples tend to evolve over time. Okay. So, what sort of flavors of questions do we want to ask? And there's pretty much two types. We want to be able to say something about the performance of a system, or possibly we want to compare the performance of two different systems. Okay. And we're going to be concentrating on the first of these. So we have a single system that we want to answer some questions about. Okay. Now, as we said last time, what we get when we run a simulation is sort of a single possible representation of the behavior of the system. Okay. In general, there would be an infinite number of ways in which the system can behave, but we're just observing a single one of those. Okay. But we can observe maybe this single behavior, or maybe we're going to have to sort of look at a number of behaviors, and then we will try to estimate system parameters. And typical ones that we try to estimate are means, so an average value for some system parameter. We'll look at an example in a second. Similarly, standard deviation. So what's the variance, the variation possible? And also, we may try to infer something about the probability distributions of a parameter. So the mean and standard deviation would be one step in that direction, but another way of looking at it is what's the probability that we're in a certain interval, so like building up a histogram, or percentiles, sort of what captures a certain, what value will capture a certain percentage of the behavior. So, we can classify our variables as, exogenous versus endogenous, or another way of saying that is independent versus dependent. And so your exogenous or independent variables are the ones that are sort of, the behavior is fixed in the model. So if we think of a queue, then we've stated what the inter-arrival time is, or at least what the distribution on the inter-arrival time is to begin with. Similarly with the service times. They're not something we're observing, they're something we're inputting into the model. On the other hand, we have other variables that are a function of those independent variables. So they're a function of our input into the model. As an example, if you again think of a queue, the amount of time any job waits in the queue is sort of dependent on this arrival and this departure process and service process. And similarly, the average number of jobs in a queue is also dependent on the arrivals and service processes. Okay. And so, in general, it's these endogenous variables that are what we're interested in. Again, this is just input. We're interested essentially in looking at the output, which is going to tell us something about the system. Okay. So, as a first step, we're just going to say a little bit about collecting this data. And again, you can think that we have, or sort of at a basic level, we assume we have our time-stamped traces. And so we may just say, well, we're going to store that data, and then we're going to sort of examine it at a later date and try and sort of infer the rest of our values from that. Okay. Now, it's possible that that could be done directly from the trace, or potentially, again, the data is some function of the trace. For instance, waiting time is the time difference between arrivals and departures. And so it is possible that you may want to build in some additional logic into your simulation model that stores whatever data you're looking for in a sort of a more usable form. Okay. So, how do we store it? Well, there's a number of possibilities. One thing is you just sort of, again, dump it all out to a file somewhere. Within the program, you would, again, sort of need some list. Again, you can do it as an array or as a linked list. Or in some cases, again, you can build additional logic into your system that sort of just stores sort of relevant data. Like you might, in some cases, all you really want is a count, so you can just store it using a counter, etc. Okay. So again, we'll go through an example, and at the moment, all we're I want you to be thinking about is, again, what you need, what sort of data you need to store to get the sort of information that you're looking for. Okay. So, this is a really straightforward example. We have a simple queue. So, jobs arrive in, and the inter-arrival process is governed by some sort of probabilistic distribution, and then jobs are serviced, and we again assume some sort of probabilistic distribution. And you might have, I think Connor's got into queues so far, and or at least mark off chains. So you probably have some picture in your mind about queues that your state is just the number of jobs in the queue, and your events are jobs can arrive or jobs can depart. Okay. And of course those happen at various times. Okay. What sort of questions might we like to ask? Well, you can think of a few that, you know, if you're ever standing in the grocery store or whatever, might be interested in. What is the average waiting time for a job? So how long does a job sit there waiting? Or how long is it sort of overall between arrival and departure for a job? What's the average number of jobs, we'll call it, in a queue? So again, if you are thinking about buffering, then sort of how big does your buffer need to be? What's your likelihood of loss, etc. And so, Connor, again, for these sort of simple examples, we'll talk about sort of mathematical techniques, but it also makes a pretty simple simulation model, and so we'll think about how we can answer those questions via simulation. Okay. So, if you want to deal with waiting time, well, you can think of that as, well, each job is going to wait a certain amount of time, and you just take the average over all of the jobs. Okay. What do we need to do this? What sort of information would we have to track? To do this, we have to somehow be able to extract waiting time for individual jobs. Now, for a first-in, first-out system, that's pretty easy. The arrivals and the departures, the ordering of the arrivals and departures is the same. So the first one to arrive is the first one to depart, and therefore you can link those two events up and compare the times between them. Okay, what's another thing we might like to look at? Again, we might like to look at the average queue length. And in general, this is a time average, and if you're thinking about simulations, you don't want to see integrals. But you can observe that the queue length is just going up or down by one with each arrival or departure. And so if we know the time between arrivals and departures, we can track the time that our queue, or the duration that queue is at a specific value. Okay, so you can think about having sort of a number of counters. Each one is, corresponding to a certain value for n, and each one is sort of incremented up whenever sort of n spends some time at a specific value. Okay. So, another question, the final one we're going to look at in our example. Is about percentiles, and so that's asking something about the relation between values for your variables and the distribution of your variable, and the question we're asking here is, what's the maximum waiting time experienced by 95% of our arrivals? Okay, so you guys might have encountered percentiles if you're doing standardized tests when you're in primary or secondary school. Typically, something that administrators like to do is they'll bin you up into you're in the 95th percentile. What that means is that you're better than 95% of your, or you got a better mark than 95% of the other students on the exam. Okay. So we'll go back and formally define that later. But again, it's a measure of sort of population. Here, what you can think of is that what we're really asking is, we want to make sure that at least 95% of our customers are happy, and so we want to make sure that 95% of them aren't experiencing a huge waiting time. Okay, so how do you, again, answer that? Well, if you, again, track enough waiting times, you can just sort of take that as your sample and order that, and sort of find the 95% point, find the person who falls at the 95% point. Again, as an example, if we had an ordered sample of 100, then the 95th one, the value for the 95th one gives us our 95th percentile value. Another thing you might have encountered would be medians. So what's the middle score? Well, the middle score is the 50th percentile. Okay. And so, again, we'll have a look at how we can sort of extract that information. Okay. So, now taking a look at this information in terms of what we need to track about our simulation. We have said so far that what we're tracking is just time-stamped behavior, the time-stamped event list. And so if we look at that, well, again, assuming that we have a FIFO discipline, we can calculate our waiting times pretty easily from that information. You have to examine the difference between arrival and departure pairs, the time difference between them. But again, your queue length is going to sort of, you'd have to have additional logic to determine queue length. Now, again, what you can infer from the sequence is how the queue length is going. You can see how the queue length is going up and down, and so from that you can extract your queue length information and, again, time intervals related to it. So you can do some additional processing and get that information out. Sort of another way, just to make life a little easier on ourselves, we can always sort of add the queue length information explicitly into our trace. Okay. So, again, the trace is just something we, again, build for ourselves to try and track information we're interested in. That doesn't have to have a specific form. So we try and add in whatever information we're interested in. And again, if we add that in, it makes it a little bit easier to then calculate what our average queue length is. Okay. Now, what if we didn't have a first-come, first-serve service discipline? So think about having a last-come, first-served. Well, the problem with that, again, is that the pairing up of arrivals and departures becomes a bit more complicated. And if you, again, want to think about waiting times, explicitly calculate the waiting time for each job, you have to know which matchup, which arrival goes to which departure. Okay. And how do you do that? Well, you need to know a little bit more. You need to sort of have a little bit more explicit tracking of the queue. So you might want to write down sort of what exactly the queue looks like at any given time, and go from there. So the moral of the story is that when you're designing your simulation, you need to think about what questions you want to ask or have answered, and then track the appropriate data. So try and make life easier on yourself. Again, if you know your model plus this original timestamp sequence, you can sort of after the fact extract any of this, but essentially what you're doing then is you're running your simulation over again to some extent. So you want to think about how you can actually extract the data while the simulation is running and make life easier on yourself. Okay. So, again, you usually have some sort of trace information that you store in your simulation, and again, you use it to so you can analyze it after the fact or sort of on a ongoing basis. Okay. In some cases, you can do sort of on-the-fly interpretation of the data. We'll see later, in some cases, you actually might have this data feeding back into your simulation, determining sort of how long the simulation should run, or, again, just tracking the values that you want. The problem with sort of single values like that is, again, if you change your mind about what you want, then you're back to having to either to rerun the simulation. Okay. So you've collected these values, and the big question then is, well, what conclusions can we make about these values? So if we think about our waiting time, we looked at one trace, so one sequence of arrivals and departures out of an infinite number of arrivals and departures. And based on that sequence, we calculated an average value. And so the first question is, is that average value representative of the system? Well, actually, that average value, it's still a random variable. If you had another trace, you'd get a different average value. So we're used to thinking of averages as being fixed numbers. In this case, they're not. They're still random. They're still variable. Okay. And similarly, our average queue size, well, that's the average queue size for this specific run, for this specific instance of system behavior. It's not in and of itself necessarily representative of the system in general. Okay. And so, depending on different initial conditions, these values are going to be different. Depending on the exact run, you get a different value. So, what we need to say is, well, we've got this run. Can we say something about the behavior of the system overall? And the roughly the straightforward answer is no, you can't from a single run. Okay. And the main problem with any given run is that the samples that we take to calculate our values, our average waiting times, our average queue size, our percentile values, are not independent of each other. So if you observe one waiting time, so for the ICE job, well, the waiting time for the I+1st job is likely to be similar. Think about if you have a congested system. Well, you're going to see that in the waiting time for the ICE job. It's going to be long. Well, the guy behind the I+1st job, he's going to experience that same sort of longer waiting time. Okay. So, again, in our first pass, what we're going to think of is that we can't just observe a single run of a system. We have to observe a number of runs for the system. So get different samples of the behavior, and then make conclusions over a number of sample behaviors. Okay. And what we say about if we have two different runs, then we can say that, you know, again, if they're started with different seeds and so they're started randomly, then we can say that the values calculated for the two different runs are independent. And if we collect together enough independent values, then we can start to make conclusions about sort of the overall system value. Okay. And so the key concept of what we're going to spend most of the lecture talking about is what's called the confidence interval. So we take these, you know, n runs. We have calculated our value for all of them. We do something fairly simple, like we average those together, and we say that that's an estimate of our overall system parameter. So over the whole system, what's the average waiting time? Well, we hope it's close to the average of we would observe over a bunch of samples. Now, that's just a sum of random variables, so it's still random. And what the confidence interval gives us then is some measure of how close our random value, the value we calculated, is to the actual system value. Okay. And what we'll see is if you, the more samples you take, the more likely it is to be close. Okay. So, before we dive into that, there's a few other things to observe about our simulations. And the first is that typically when you start, your simulation value is going to be dependent on your initial conditions. So if you think about queues again, this is the only example we'll give for the whole lecture, but typically we start with nobody in the queue, and then over time the queue builds up. If your system is stable, then the queue length should have some average value, and obviously in order to get that average value, it should be bouncing up and down around that average. But if we looked at a simulation run which was very short, we aren't going to get anywhere particularly near the average. Again, because it's just dependent on our starting point. If we continue our simulation run longer and longer, what we should see is, again, when we do our samples, we're going to get somewhere near this average value. And so what we say is that for a simulation, the behavior breaks itself up into two periods. You have a transient phase where your simulation is still affected by the initial conditions, and then you have a steady state phase where it's no longer dependent on the initial conditions. And so in some way we have to deal with this transient phase, and there's two things you can do essentially. One is not start taking samples at all until you've determined you're out of the transient phase. And so the question is, how do you do that? Usually, again, you'd be taking something like a running average and hoping that it's not changing too much. The second thing is just, again, if you keep on your simulation long enough, even if you include in these initial values, they become a smaller and smaller contribution until they're negligible. Okay. Sometimes, it is of interest to look at transient states, but what we're going to look at here is the steady state. Okay. So when a system is up and running, how is it going to behave? Okay, and so again, the point here is that you have to account for that transient phase. It can be quite short. Of the assignment we ran last year, actually we asked them to say something about the transient phase, but they couldn't find it because it actually jumped up to steady state quite quickly. So it can be quite a short period. Okay, and again, you either discard the data in the transient phase or run the simulation long enough that it becomes a negligible contribution. Okay, so assuming now that we're in steady state, we're going to look at the estimation of system parameters. Okay. And we're going to do sort of a very detailed discussion of the estimation of mean values of parameters, so the average value for a system parameter. And we're going to illustrate our idea of confidence interval for this mean value. And then we're going to look at why percentiles and variances you can either treat in the same way or why they need special handling. Okay. So we start with some system parameter theta. And again, we can think of that as our average Q length. So overall, if you could look at all the behavior of this possible behavior of the system, you could average the Q length over all the possible behaviors, and you would get this one number, theta. Now, the problem is that we're not looking at all of the values. We're only looking at 1, 2, 3, 10, 100 values. And so what we get is an estimator for that parameter, theta, what we call theta hat. Okay. And so in our example, again, we would
take our average sort of for each run, and then if for our estimator, we would just average all our averages.
Okay. And again, why do we need more than one run? Because for a single run, our samples are not independent of each other. Now, we are going to look at how, we're going to sort of look at how we can interpret single runs as independent samples, but for now, let's just think we need a number of runs. Okay. So, we get our estimator theta hat for theta. So we have an estimate for the average Q size, which is gotten by figuring out the average Q size for each run and then averaging all those. And the final piece of information that we want to gather is how likely is theta hat to be near theta? Or flipping that around, how near theta is theta hat likely to be? And what we're going to see is that, so here's theta, which we don't know. Here's our theta hat. And we're going to be able to play between an interval and the probability of theta hat being in that interval. So obviously the bigger the interval, the higher the probability. The smaller the interval, the lower the probability. Okay. And so the confidence interval really captures those two quantities, the size of the interval and the probability of being in that interval. Okay. So we have our IID random variables, x1 through xn, and each of these has a mean mu and a variance theta. Now, for us, again, each of these is sort of the value we got from our sample run. So the average Q size, that xi is the average Q size for each run I. Or here we looked at the waiting time, so it's the same thing. We've calculated the average waiting time for each run I. Okay. And sort of seems reasonable, we're going to say that our system average is just the average of all our sample values. Okay. So we've observed a number of random variables. What's the mean of them? Well, it's just sort of the mean of our, it's the average of our observations. And as a first pass, we're going to do the same thing as the variance. The variance is just sort of an average over all of over the variance for all of the observations. Okay. And so what we'd like is for that to be in some way representative of the actual system parameters. It's obviously not the system parameter. It's still random, but we'd like it to be close. Okay. So the measure, or sort of the first measure of how good an estimate it is what's called bias. And so we have our random variable, which is theta hat. And if we take its mean value,
Ideally, what we'd like is that to be the mean value of the system. Okay. We can't actually take the mean value because, we don't know what the distribution is, but we'd like it to be the same as the system. Okay. And we say that an estimate is unbiased, well, if there's a bias of zero, or if, again, this average is the same. Okay. And for our values, our mean estimator, it turns out, is unbiased, and our variance estimator, S squared, there is biased. Okay. So typically, we don't just take the average, we don't take the average variance for the value, but instead we use this 1 over n minus 1 value for our estimator of variance. Okay, and so we can go through and take a look at all of these, and again, you can pretty easily demonstrate that our mean estimator is unbiased, and obviously I lost the bar over the x there somewhere, and so you can grind that out. The expectation is just the expectation of the sum of these variables, and since this is a finite sum, we can move the expectation inside. Well, it's a finite sum. They're independent. You can move the expectation inside. Each one of these, the expectation of each of these variables is mu, and so you get the system average mu out. Okay. Now, if you try the same trick for our first bias, or our first variance estimator, again, you can just grind it out. You expand out your xi minus x bar squared term, and then you look at each of the individual terms, and so you get the expectation of 1 over n sum I equals 1 to n xi minus mu squared. Well, that's the variance, so that gives you sigma squared. Your other terms, that's the variance of each xi, so that gives you sigma squared. Your other terms collapse down into the expectation of x bar minus mu squared. So you have our variance squared, but then you have this additional term of how far off is our estimator from the actual system average. So how far off is the system estimator from the system average? And so that gives you something less than sigma squared. Okay. So, again, there's like a first test saying that this is not quite your best estimator. So, our second crack at the estimator is, instead of using 1 over n, we use 1 over n minus 1. And again, we can sort of expand out our terms. We'll pull out the n minus 1 for the moment. And so expand out your inner terms. And just So then, again, since there's a finite sum, you can pull the expectations inside and just sort of massage it a bit, and you get that we have n e to the xi squared minus n e to the x bar squared. Okay, now, by definition of variance, each of these terms is just sigma squared plus mu squared, so you have sigma squared plus mu squared, and then minus sigma bar squared plus mu bar squared, and then again, since these values are just averages from the so then we at this point we use one trick, and we'll look at the central limit theorem in we'll look at it in a bit more detail in a minute, but what the central limit theorem says is that if you have sums of IID random variables, which is where these terms come from, they come from the average of xi and the average of the variance in xi. So the average is obtained by summing. Then your distribution is normal, and the variance sort of goes down with n, and the mean stays the same. Okay. And finally, if we can work that all out too, we do get our sigma squared back. Okay, so all we've said sort of there is that in some measure our mean estimator is pretty good, and again the second variance estimator is pretty good in the sense that at least if you take a mean value, then you hit the right value. Okay. What we don't say is anything about any greater distribution for either of those. Okay. So, we have now defined our estimators. And again, we want to say how close are they to the actual system parameter. So, if we ran different simulations, so if we kept taking different batches, these estimators would all be different. So each time we take some batch of M, they're all going to be the values will all be slightly different. Some of them might not be close to theta at all. You could just get unlucky and for some reason you took these M and they're just not back, they're not typical samples in some way. They're somewhere far off from the actual value. Okay. So the final sort of piece to this puzzle is to try and quantify how close our observed values are to our actual system value. And we can't say anything completely definitive because we don't know whether we've got one of these typical ones or whether we've got one of these atypical ones. But what we can say is something about what's the likelihood of getting one of these atypical ones that's far away. Okay. So we define two quantities.
we have a confidence level, and what the confidence level says is, what's the probability of being within some interval around our actual system parameter? And obviously that's dependent on the size of our interval around the parameter. So what we can do is we can pick a confidence level and then say what size our interval is around the parameter. So the higher our confidence level, if we want 99.9999% certainty, well, unless we've done a lot of work in taking a lot of runs, our interval is going to be pretty wide on that. 95%, well, you typically expect, if you've taken a reasonable number of runs, that yeah, it's going to be somewhere in there. Okay. The opposite way is to say, well, I want an interval, I want to of a certain size, and what's the probability that I lie in that interval? Okay. So typically, what you choose is the confidence level, and then calculate the interval. But again, it's just two sides of the same coin. And typical confidence levels are sort of in the 90% range. Okay. So we rely on the central limit theorem to produce these results. Okay. And what the central limit theorem does is it gives us a distribution to go along with our observations. Okay. And so what we've said is we have one run, I, and we calculated xi for it, and we don't know anything about the distribution for xi. Now, if we were to sum up a bunch of xi's, then the sum of their values has a normal distribution. And typically, since we don't want that distribution to be dependent explicitly on the number we're summing up, we divide out by the 1 over n. And so, again, if you take the average, this essentially gives us the average value of all these random variables, then for big enough n, the distribution x bar of n looks normal with an average value of mu and a variance of sigma squared over n. So again, the variance is going down as you take more and more values. Okay, so what does a normal distribution look like? Well, again, just this is sort of interesting. This shows you what the this starts with uniform random variables and shows you what the distribution looks like as you sum up more and more of them. Okay. And so the mean, again, is at a half. And you can see how it becomes more and more curvy as we go along. And the other thing you can see is how you get tighter and tighter into the mean as we go along. So the more values you sum up, the more likely they are to be close to the mean. Now, so in general, the way people look at normal distributions is what's called thinking about the bell curve. And again, this is a distribution that's typically applied in education to large populations. And we assume that there are a lot of people who are average, and then you can classify sort of how far away from average you are, and that's used, that will be done in terms of how many standard deviations are you away from this average value. Okay. Now, what's of interest to us is sort of the relation between standard deviations and what portion of the curve falls between those two points. Okay, and so obviously that's our interval. Here, if you wanted 95% of the population to lie within your interval, well, you can see that your interval has to be, the endpoints of the interval have to be pretty close to 2 sigma. Okay, so this accounts for a little over 2%, this accounts for a little over 2%. So 95.6, I guess, percent fall within 2 standard deviations of the mean. Okay. So that essentially is our relationship between our confidence interval and our confidence level. If we take enough samples, then our average has this normal distribution or is pretty close to this normal distribution. And so we're again asking questions about sort of what percentage of the normal curve lies within a specific interval. Okay. And so here is our example, and typically, yeah, you can't really just calculate this out mathematically, or at least there's no neat form for the solution. So typically, the way this information is stored is in a table, and again, the table has sort of 2 elements. It has the percentage under the curve, and then the fraction of the standard deviation. Okay. Now, depending on which table you look at, they may only look at half the curve. This table only looks at half the curve. It looks at this, well, doesn't matter which side it looks at, but it only looks at half the curve. So it's looking at between the mean and one in sort of some standard deviation away from the mean. Okay. And so it's just something to watch out for. Other ones may give you the sort of both sides of the curve. So here we're looking at half the curve. So obviously we should have half our percentages stored in that half of the curve. And so we should have 47.5% is what is the value we want. So that's our confidence level. We want 95% to fall within on either side of the mean,
which means 47.5% is going to fall on one side of the mean. And then we read off our value, and we get the two numbers here, 1.9, and then going up, we get the third, the last digit, which is 6. So 95% of the values fall within plus or minus 1.96 times sigma of the mean.
So we have, for our problem, we have our mean estimator, and we take sufficient samples, and sort of as a rule of thumb, 30 or more is good to get this normal distribution. And so we take our 30 or more samples, and we can then calculate our confidence interval using the normal distribution. Okay. To do that, we would need to know our standard deviation, our sigma. Well, we already said we didn't know that, but we have an estimator for it. So we use the estimator for the standard deviation. And applying that, our value for sigma is just the estimator divided by square root of n. And that gives us our confidence interval. So, again, just to recap, the 1.96 comes from the the normal distribution, and we decide that 95% of the population lies in plus or minus 1.96 of sigma times your standard deviation. We don't actually know standard deviation, so we estimate it using S. And again, that comes from the square root of n comes from the central limit theorem. Okay, and so what we can observe from that is, again, the more samples we take, the tighter our confidence interval is going to be. And that intuitively should make sense to you. The more times you sort of observe, sort of the less likely you are to sort of have all outlier observations. You're more likely to capture sort of the normal average behavior of the system. Okay. So frequently we may not have our 30 samples, and work has been done on distributions when you don't have that many samples, and one of the most best known ones would be the student's T distribution. And so if you have a small number of samples, you want to apply this same idea, but you can't assume you have a normal distribution. You assume the student's T distribution instead. Okay. And we're not going to go into the exact details of this, but note that this student's T distribution now is a function of how many samples you actually have. So the values change depending on how many samples you have. Okay, this is captured in degrees of freedom, and for our purposes, all that means is the number of samples minus 1. Okay. So if you have 11 samples, the degrees of freedom would be 10. And so if you wanted to calculate a confidence interval, you'd look at the student's T distribution for 10 degrees of freedom. Okay. And so now if we want our confidence interval at 95%, we need to again take a look at exactly which, what sort of data this table is giving us. So our last table gave us the population between the mean and some multiple of the standard deviation. This table, of course, couldn't do that. It's actually giving you the population between the multiple of the standard deviation and infinity. So it's giving you 0.5 minus what we got before. Okay. So again, the moral of that story is always look carefully at the information your table is giving you. It's more or less the same thing, but you know, just depending on how they lay it out, you'll again have to subtract one, take the value with one, take the value out of one, or take the value out of the half, multiply by two, do something to get the exact value we want. But anyway, what we have is this tail. Well, obviously what we want is that 2.5% of the population, or no more than 2.5% of the population lies in that tail. Okay, so 2.5% lies on that side, 2.5% lies on that side, 95% then has to lie in the middle. And so we look up our value then, 0.025 is 2.5%, and 10 degrees of freedom, that gives you this 2.2814 value. And again, that's a multiple of your standard deviation. And our standard deviation then is estimated as it was before. Okay. So it's the exact same idea, but slightly different, a different assumption on the distributions because we haven't taken enough samples for it to be normal. Okay. Excuse me. And so just as a final point, as you sort of keep going on, the student's T will begin to resemble a normal distribution more and more. But in general, it's a bit more spread out. Okay, so just to recap, well, we've done two things and we've sort of done them at the same time. We have looked at estimating a specific system parameter. In this case, the mean, and then we have discussed the concept of confidence intervals, and again with a big example in relationship to that specific parameter of the mean. Okay, so I'm going to take a break here. And when we return, we will look at the estimate of a few different system parameters. And so, again, ideally what we want to do is come up with some estimator. It's going to be a function of a number of runs. And if we take enough runs, we'd like to be able to calculate our confidence intervals as well. Okay. So we'll look at percentiles, and I'll say a word about variance. Variance is a little more complicated. And then finally we will look at, again, actually gathering our samples, and so we'll compare a bunch of several techniques which involve either, again, a number of runs or somehow sort of being clever about single runs to be able to apply the same methodology depending on how you gather your data. Okay, so we'll take about a 15-minute break, and then we'll continue on with those subjects.